Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is a senior fellow at the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics and a great journalist, Soviet-born Peter Pomerantsev. And remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom at gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to this week's sponsors, Chili Sleep, Smith AI, and HelloFresh in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. And please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. Peter Pomerantsev, born in Kyiv, an author, journalist, expert on disinformation. We appreciate you joining us, Peter. You're going to be a great guest. There's so much to talk about, but let's just start with President Zelensky's remarkable address to a joint session of Congress. His tone, the history, citing Pearl Harbor, 9/11, I Have a Dream, that compelling video of the beauty and the brutality in the country where you were born. How did it strike you, and did you get a chance to see Biden's response?
So I have to be honest, I was teaching today, and so I watched the video just because everybody was sharing it, but I haven't sat down and sort of deconstructed it bit by bit. But generally, I mean, Zelensky has had a remarkably good war as a communicator. I'm very interested to know afterwards who's helping him write the speeches, because they seem very well calibrated to different audiences. He has a great speechwriting team anyway. It's the one thing that he was always very good at. His speeches internally were always very good. But I'm just interested, like, you know, how he's calibrating specifically for these audiences now, these international ones.
But even with good speechwriters, though, are you a little surprised, or did you have a sense before that he could rise to this occasion? I mean, this is, I don't know, Churchillian is obviously, you know, a little bit of a reach maybe, but it's been pretty damn impressive.
I think, like many people, I wasn't sure. He was not a perfect prime minister in any way, but his gift has always been communication.
Right.
But somebody, a senior Ukrainian-American academic who knows him a little bit, because I've never met him, mentioned this a little bit before the war, that you don't understand this man. He's been looking for the role of his life, his whole life, and this is the role of his life. And that's not a criticism. But actually, he sees his own destiny in this. And he's, again, the word playing is the wrong word, because that denotes fake. I'm not saying he's fake. I'm just saying this is what he feels he was, like, the role that he was destined to play, and he knows how to play it. Strategic reforms of the economy and the judiciary were not his cup of tea, frankly, and one that we could ask many questions about. This sort of thing, I mean, talk about come the moment, come the man. But that's his communication capabilities. But the fact that he, there's something deeper going on. You know, great leaders feel a connection to the nation. Now, that can be really creepy, as in, like, you know, Hitler saying, "Ich bin das Volk," I am the nation. And Putin claims something like that. That's very creepy. But the gift of great leaders is to tap into the nation's mood. What Zelensky has always argued is that because he's a bottom-up celebrity, he has gone around every village in Ukraine doing comedy shows in the local town hall. His claim has always been, "I don't need your sociology. I know Ukrainians. I know them because I know what makes them laugh. I know what makes a 7 p.m. show work, which is the best sociology in the world. And I have physically been to all these places and communicated with people." That's why he managed to unite the nation when he won a 70% landslide, crossing every divide in the nation. And he's doing it now again. So, you know, I think he actually genuinely feels that he kind of gets the nation. He can channel it. And my God, he's right.
Yeah. You also know Ukraine, and you've written about being in touch with some friends who are there. What is your sense of how they are? Can they hold out?
Oh, I mean, look, I'm having many sleepless nights, and I feel very on edge. When I call my friends in Ukraine, some of whom have picked up weapons and are in Kharkiv, which is one of the cities under siege, many of whom are journalists going from city to city, and others who might be in the government but have ended up doing stuff they never thought they'd be doing, they're full of a really grim resolve, horrified by what the Russians are doing, but with a real sense of purpose and togetherness that, frankly, you know, helps me deal with things. I'm much more flappy than they are.
Yeah. Well, boy, they sure have courage. Peter, before I turn it over to James, you also lived in Moscow for, I think, almost a decade, written books and done television documentaries. What, looking at Putin today, what do you see as his state of mind and where that might lead him?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can really do the kind of like, you know, we can analyze his language and what his language is saying and revealing, because the language reveals more than maybe he understands. Mm-hmm. And we can analyze his aims, or try to. His state of mind, I mean, I don't think he's become a suicide bomber. I don't think he's suicidal. I don't think he's looking to do anything that will usurp his rule. In his logic and in his calculations, you know, he wants to achieve something that he thinks is great and important and satisfying. But like many aging leaders, he's lost his touch. He's not looking at the evidence. He's closed himself up. So he's miscalculating a lot. But I don't buy this thing that he's gone mad, if by mad we mean he's looking for self-destruction, he's ready to blow the world up. He's the same Putin that we always had, who was always very calculating. It's just he's become really bad at calculating, like an old chess player who gets really bad at chess and starts messing up his moves. That's where we're at.
James Carville.
So Peter, I'm going to get right to the crux of the matter here. You're a scholar of propaganda. I'm a purveyor of propaganda. I think we need to have a huge propaganda campaign within Russia itself. And what we should set up, we should, you know, if they engaged, they were part of the global world. They have iPhones, they have, you know, canceled Visa accounts. What could we come up with that would, in a propaganda war in Russia, that could bring Putin some grief? Because I don't think we're very good at this. You know, we were very good at it in World War I. We had the Committee on Public Information, George Creel. We were very good at it in World War II. George Stevens' dad was encamped, and John Ford and all these directors were encamped in the White House. Do we have a good propaganda effort going on in Russia? And what can we do to have a better one?
So, firstly, in World War II, the American efforts were not very good compared to the British ones. I'm writing a book about the British political warfare executive, so we can get into that debate if we like.
Right.
But you know, okay. That's
well,
sort of
try.
Like,
okay, we try.
But I think the Cold War and the U.S. Information Agency is a much more relevant example and much more recent.
Okay.
But let's first break down this term propaganda. So in Eastern Europe, the word propaganda is not negative. It's just mass persuasion.
Right.
In the West, we have a lot of problems with it.
Okay.
I definitely think we need an organized, strategic, democratic communication campaign towards the Russian people.
Right.
I don't think it needs to be based on deception or disinformation. I think it can deal with honest engagement. I don't rule out the role of PSYOPs, the military or the secret services, but they do what they do, and usually it's a bloody mess. But I'm talking about the sort of, you know, the stuff that we did in the Cold War, which was very transparent and above board. The sort of black propaganda stuff in the Cold War usually blew up in our faces, frankly. So we're not talking about something sort of like dastardly. We're talking about engaging the Russian people about, you know, their future and our future and life and death. And the thing is, we don't really have a coherent institutional basis for that. Our theory of change when it comes to communication and boosting democratic communication is kind of from the 1990s. We sprinkle a bit around for, here's some media development money, bye-bye. Here's something for USAGM, which is sort of the journalism that the Congress supports in places like Russia. Go off and do your own thing. Here's public diplomacy, but we don't remember how to do it. Here's some audience analysis happening with some sociology professors. None of it is connected. Here's a bit of OSINT monitoring that somebody else is doing, maybe in the CIA, but why isn't it public? So we have all these bits and bobs. None of them come together. And then there's the really important bit, which you just mentioned, the technology factor. So firstly, we need to think about institutional coordination. How do we bring these bits together so they actually have some sort of strategic impact? That's the first thing. The second thing, what is, you know, what are the aims, the values, and the strategies? You know, and we should get into a conversation about that. Let's get the ball rolling. You just talked about the tech aspect. So the Ukrainian Minister for Digital, young guy, the sort of guy that you'd easily see hanging out in Silicon Valley, very much that kind of personality from the tech sector. He tweeted the other day, Google and Apple have this incredible power to communicate directly with Russians because everybody has Android and Apple phones. Why can't they, you know, download information about what's going on in Ukraine directly to Russians? And first I was like, that's crazy. And then I was like, no, it's not crazy at all. What it means, though, is the tech companies stopping claiming that they live in some sort of like nebulous reality beyond politics, but actually taking a stand in the fight between truth and lies and between democracy and dictatorship and between evidence and war crimes. That's what we're talking about. We're not telling them to take a stand between America and Russia. We're talking about war crimes being committed and information about that not being shared with the population of the country in whose name they are being committed. So, you know, I think he's saying a very, very important thing. And maybe that's one of the big, big topics to think about. Is it time for Apple, for Google, to take a stance in that fight between truth and lies and between humanitarian justice and war crimes?
It's past time. Okay, let's call it a public information campaign because propaganda has a bad connotation. Whatever it is. You know, Visa and MasterCard, they don't accept anymore. They got the names of all of these Russians that were paying them bills. You can send them stuff. There's stuff that you can do to undermine this. You can tell the Russians that they're in danger of becoming vassals of the Chinese, which will scare the shit out of them. All right? That we're begging, you know, Russia's begging China for help. You need to know this. The tech companies, I mean, honestly, fuck them. We train their engineers. They're here. They profit off our tax code. They use our infrastructure. You're a U.S.-based company, and most of your business is done in the West. Pass laws. We don't have time to screw with you. I mean, I think I'm very... Feel free to walk me back, but I'm very hard-ass on this stuff. And we gotta go really hard, and we got to go really hard internally in Russia.
I think generally, I mean, there's a lot of questions to ask about, you know, the role of technology and the role of business in where we see the future of the world. I mean, clearly we're seeing the emergence of a cabal of dictatorships who want to make the world safe for dictatorship. And they're not allies in the classic sense, but they're increasingly coordinated and they're increasingly determined. And the theory of change was if we had business with them, if we had technological exchange with them, we'd have a happy, more democratic world. That theory of change is dead, clearly dead. If anything, it's the opposite. So that does mean that business and tech companies have to take a position. Now, I don't think, you know, what is the we that we're referencing? I think it has to be a position based in human rights, in humanitarian law, in humanitarian values, rather than just the whim of the US government, because frankly, the next president that we have in the US might also not be particularly inclined to facts, evidence, and confronting war crimes, let's be honest. So they have to be, I think, in a slightly different value set. But it does mean taking a stand on these things. And clearly that's something that really hasn't happened. But let's get back to what the US government should be doing, because that's something that you know, maybe we can get more traction on and quicker. I mean, what do you think, James? I hear a lot of discussion in DC. I'm new to DC. I only came here 6 months ago, and I'm still trying to work this strange city out. Do we need a more coordinated, you know, democratic communications infrastructure, a USAID for democratic communications or something?
Of course we do. And of course I was wrong. A lot of people were wrong that if we engage them and if we no two countries that trade with each other never go to war, a lot of us bought into that shit. All right? We just did. Let's just be honest here. The whole Washington consensus on the world was just fucking wrong. All right? But now we know that. And as we used to say, now's not the time to look back, but to look forward. All right? We need to go after them and of course, the democratic message in the United States is constipated. It's always been constipated. I don't think there's enough Ex-lax in the world to deconstipate democratic message in the United States. But I do think that we can put together and push for a huge public information campaign inside of Russia. And inside of, you know, that Western Europe has been, and it was also part of, well, the Western Europeans, they're just secular, they're weak, they can't get together. Shit, the big hero in this whole thing, other than Zelensky, is the European street. These politicians weren't going to move, and they saw 150,000 people in a tear garden, and they went, oh, shit, I didn't know this. I mean, the Finns, the Swedes, the Swiss, all right? I just think we need a massive public information campaign that's directed in a lot of different places. That's what I really believe.
Well, let's focus on Russia for now, because that's really where this is all about. I mean, at the end of the day, this situation doesn't fundamentally change until there is a real change of public opinion in Russia, sentiments in Russia, and the direction that the regime is going in. In terms of you know, understanding how far it can take its own nation down the route of a murderous and horrific war. So one bit of that is the technology bit. Putin is, like, you know, closing down Instagram, Facebook, YouTube's about to stop. Trying to do anything on Russian social media is really hard. You can't just go up and buy ads or something. So there's a technology piece. So you're talking about investing in satellites, satellite TV and shortwave radio. Are we going full Cold War? That's a technology piece. But then there's technology you can always do something with in this day and age. But then there's the much, much, much more difficult bits, which is the how do you actually engage? I mean, we know there's 13, 15% of people who are really anti-war. You know, they're clearly going to be ready to engage. But the Kremlin's probably not worried about them. There's maybe 30, 40% who are pro-war, either very pro-war or mildly, and there'll be a block in the middle who don't know. Look, it's changing all the time, but usually societies end up like that, even in dictatorships. What would be your sort of methodology and your strategic aims in engaging with them?
Well, I mean, the methodology I leave to people that understand how you can communicate and all of different ways that you can penetrate it. And my message to them is you want to have a great country. This is undermining you. You're making yourself dependent on the Chinese. You're losing people. I mean, some people think they lost 4 more Russian soldiers so far in Ukraine than we lost in the entire Afghan war. Well, fucking tell Russian people about it. And the people that you're going to have access to are obviously people who have Visa, MasterCard, who shop at Amazon. But we have all these names, all right? We got the Apple has all the phone numbers and names of these people. Just start causing massive disruption, massive doubt to the extent you can do it. I don't know if it'll work, but, you know, when you're at war, you try everything. You try everything. And that's my thing. So before I turn it over to Al, because I'm dominating your time too much, and I apologize. I worked in your country in, I think, 2007 or so. When I worked there, I flew to Kiev, and I worked in the Ukraine. All right? Now you fly to Kyiv, and you work in Ukraine. Just give us a little bit of background on the nomenclature here, because Anne Applebaum was very strong. Don't call it the Ukraine, James. You have to call it Ukraine. And now there's no such thing as KEIV, the place that we studied about in World War II that got overrun by the Germans. Just give us a little bit of a cultural lesson about your country and the language.
So the Ukraine versus Ukraine is to do, when you call it the Ukraine, you're kind of saying it's like a relational spatial definition. It basically means the edge. So you're saying, it's different saying like edge is the name of the country or the edge is the name of the country. We're calling it the edge, you're saying it's on the edge of something else. So you're kind of like play, you know, like, you're like making it more diminutive. You know, it's a place on the edge of Russia, Austro-Hungary, whatever. So that's why the is significant. But a lot of these things, I mean, they're important because of context. And they're important because that's the way imperial powers refer to it. It's that place on the edge. Therefore, it's not a real country. It's just the periphery. So it's important not because people fixate on the and they care that much about articles. It's because it's the way that it was referred to within a context by imperial superpowers who, as you can see, still deny Ukraine its rights to sovereignty and identity. Kiev again, it's like Kiev was the spelling that was pushed by Moscow. Kiev is the pronunciation in Ukrainian and the spelling in Ukrainian. Again, these things are all about context. In another context, maybe it wouldn't matter that much, but it's all about the history. It's all about understanding context, and that's why it's important.
Great. Okay, Alvin, I'm sorry. I spent too much of Peter's time.
No, I would just say, Peter, go on your point. I think we have something, at least the beginnings of the of an infrastructure with the Voice of America and its parent company. Of course, Trump wrecked it by putting in a, you know, some kind of a political hack. But you can build on that. You talked about how effective some of it was during the Cold War. There's no reason it can't be effective again. But I also wonder, Peter, that I think one of the really smart things Biden did was to release the intelligence beforehand. He let everybody know what they were going to do, and then they did it. And that must have rattled Putin a little bit.
Yeah, it was definitely an innovative step. I think it was very innovative. And it's something we've been pushing for a long time. We're always like, we always did it. We as in the community of people who care about this, in the context of corruption. Why don't you leak more stuff about where the dirty money is? Finally, they're doing that. And all these interesting things are coming out. I know it's hard for intelligence agencies to do that. And even then, people were super skeptical. You know, journalists were like, well, how can we believe you? They're like, you got to believe us. And they're like, tell us your sources. And they're like, of course, we're not going to say our sources. So it was still hard. The thing that I would say, though, just going up and doing that in a press briefing is not enough. So if we had a proper infrastructure, you would have the equivalent of, I don't know, online town halls in all the countries of Europe and in Ukraine, where US officials would be doing online presentations in the local languages, communicating with local journalists about it. Just having Jen Psaki or her various colleagues brief, you know, the White House press corps, that's still very naive. Look, look at it this way. The authoritarians, the Russians, the Chinese, the Saudis, even the bloody Hungarians now, they have their own information war infrastructure. We know what that is. It's lying state propaganda. It's troll farms. It's all this nasty stuff. We have to have our alternative, which is built on completely different values. So they do troll farms, we do online town halls, but in every audience that matters across the world, you know? So that's what I mean. We need to have a whole machine that is doing this with, you know, which is commensurate to our values or the values we claim to have. But it is just as targeted, just as focused on different audiences. Even now, Russia is wiping our whatever in the Middle East. RT and their troll farms are completely winning the narrative battle in the Middle East. This is all NATO's fault. This whole war is America's fault in the Middle East. Even in Central Europe, in Bulgaria, in Hungary, Russian or Russian proxy media are doing great damage, still working very, very hard. Nobody is working with those audiences. The same in Latin America. Look, this is an international tussle. The Russians have got a bloody nose, an informational bloody nose, in the Western America, partly because Putin didn't tell his info war people what was about to happen. They couldn't prepare. He didn't tell anyone what was about to happen. He didn't tell the bloody army by the looks of it. So they didn't prepare. They couldn't, you know, roll out their campaigns. They will, yeah? Just because a couple of European countries banned RT doesn't mean the Russians have gone. Democracies are always open. We will always have ways to get information from autocracies into our systems. That's the nature of democracies. Within a few months, Russia will be rolling out a huge campaign talking about Ukrainian atrocities. Well-meaning literary magazines will publish stories about how the Ukrainians shelled themselves or something, how this was all NATO's fault. This narrative will return. And in order to engage with it, you will have to engage in a very honest and earnest way with audiences across Europe, across the Middle East. Who's going to do that? Whose job is that? No one's.
How well did the British do on that, Peter?
At least we have a theory of change, but I still don't think we have an infrastructure. I still don't think there's a kind of... We really need to imagine what is democratic communication in a 21st century. You know, the Cold War stuff just shows that we know how to do it. We can't just roll out our Cold War models and hope they're going to work. So the British do think about it. We like to think we're really good at it. And they're certainly talented people, but I don't think we've really coalesced this into infrastructure. We'd see it. I mean, this can't be something hidden. You know, this has to be something that just exists, like a USAID that focuses on communication.
Yeah. Let me get you, before I turn it back to James, let me get you to put your Russian expert hat on for a moment. And just two questions. Does Putin face any threat from within, or is that just unrealistic? And what's your realistic good case ending for all this?
Oh, look, he's miscalculating horribly. So suddenly we're in this new zone where Putin is in this spiral of bad decision-making. And I think James said something very, very powerful there, which is very true. Look, the Russian project is bigger than Putin. This is a great power with vast history, with a bureaucrat class, with a security class, with classes. You know, this is not even though Putin's managed to sort of seal power around himself in many ways, it's still a system. That system can just go on strike, you know. If the bureaucracy just says, nope, this ain't happening, or if the army just says, nope, this ain't happening, then you have this sort of paralysis. Putin can keep on pressing buttons, but the system won't work. No, we're not at that place yet, but we could get there if he keeps on miscalculating. If the system, and it is a system, it's a serious country with, you know, that depends on a lot of very well-educated, very, very usually highly motivated people to do their job. So it can essentially just go on strike. And if he continues messing up, we'll be like the late Soviet Union, where the system just stops working. Putin's system so far has not been a totalitarian one. It's been an authoritarian kleptocratic one based on a pyramid of mutually reinforcing corrupt self-interests from the traffic cop through to the minister. That's disappeared. There's no money left to do that through. You were meant to do ideology once a week, say, oh, I believe in the ideology, and then you go and live your personal life and make your money. That was the system. After 2014, it got a little bit less profitable for everyone, but it was still pretty much working. What he's gone and done is set fire to the whole of that system. In his head, he wants to do Stalin 2.0. He wanted to switch to a totalitarian dictatorship. Does he have the repressive muscle to do that? I don't know. These kind of security guys that he's created around himself, they're kind of cosplaying Beria, Stalin's head of the KGB. Whether they can do Beria, whether they can arrest tens, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, whether they can build prisons to house them, unclear. So, you know, in his head, that's what he wants to do. His rhetoric is clearly a totalitarian rhetoric. Just now, he's been on Russian TV saying he's going to purge and cleanse the nation of vermin. That's anyone who disagrees with him. So he's using totalitarian language, which is getting ready for sort of mass repressions. But again, he might press a button and the system is so corrupt, it's so incompetent, that maybe what he thinks it will do won't happen.
So, Peter, let's talk a little raw politics here. And I'm going back, it was some time ago, probably 15 years ago, that I worked in Ukraine. But the general rule of Ukrainian politics is the further west you go, the more anti-Russian you are. I know there's exceptions to every rule, but they have a democracy, and the western part of the country is clearly looks more to the west. So he's annexed Crimea, which was a voting stronghold for the Putin. He's called in the Party of Regions when I was there. Or you annex Donbass, which is the real stronghold of the pro-Russian party. So I don't know how he lets Ukrainian democracy back, because if he was a Republican, he would have gotten rid of Texas and Utah, all right? I mean, he's really diminished, and they had a lot of influence in Ukrainian politics back then, and you know, up until the corruption. But the more that he gobbles up from the east, the more anti-Russian Ukrainian politics becomes. Is that analysis makes sense to you?
Completely. I mean, and again, that's why very many people didn't expect this war to happen, because he's actually undermining the kind of the more subtle control he could have had over Ukraine, manipulating its politics. And look, James, there's a separate reality where a flourishing, successful Russia is so attractive that many Ukrainians want to be part of it. The fact is, like, at some level, despite Putin's image of himself as the greatest Russian leader since Peter the Great, probably, in his own mind, he's created a model that every country around wants to run away from, even Central Asian states, which are, you know, brutal dictatorships in some cases. So there's a kind of a personal offense going on, you know, like, how dare they choose something else? But listen, you know, everything that Putin does in many ways actually shortens the life of the Russian Empire. You know, he gets these sort of short-term wins, but in the long term, everything he does pushes Ukrainians, Georgians, Belarusians away. But again, you know, he's, you know, maybe he doesn't look that far into the future. Maybe this is a man who thinks in much more sort of tactical and short-term ways.
So before I turn it over to Al, a lot of people have, I don't because of work there, attitude, you know, that part of the world, James, they're just going back and forth. And a lot of they speak Russian. And you know, is that a real country, like Italy is a real country or Kenya's or whatever? Give us a quick lesson on why Ukraine is a real country with a real culture and real interest that deserves to be heard on the world stage.
Well, look, I can give you a history lesson. You know, go back to Byron, who's already writing about Ukraine as this incredibly like romantic notion, same as he's writing about Greece. You know, during this great, you know, romantic period where you celebrate the emergence of nations as this romantic ideal. Byron goes off and dies for Greece, but at the same time writes one of his most famous long poems about Mazeppa, about, you know, an early Ukrainian leader trying to free Ukraine from imperial power. So, you know, as long as we've had ideas of nations, Ukraine has been one of those ideas. Okay. So very, as an good idea, it's existed, you know, since that period at least, which is when you know European ideas of nations are formed. But listen, you know, sod that history lesson. I mean, anyone can look that up in Wikipedia. The great scholar of what is a nation, Benedict Anderson, comes up with this idea of a nation as an imagined community. He had a very, very quick rule of whether a nation exists or not. And that's if our people are prepared to die for it. And I think Ukrainians have answered that question pretty strongly. They've actually answered it many times in their history, but now we can all see it and can't run away from that. And the question is, not is Ukraine a real country? The question is Russia a real country? Russia is actually a hodgepodge of different statelets and republics. It still thinks of itself as an empire. And whether people are prepared to die for the Russian idea, whether people are prepared to die for this idea that Putin has, that Ukraine is not a real country, that all is part of one great folk, one great Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian people. He uses language straight out of the Nazi nomenclature. Are people prepared to die for that? Putin is hiding this war from his own people. He's saying there are no casualties. If you say the word war, you get 12 years in prison for saying the word war. That doesn't speak to a country in the sense of an imagined community where people are prepared to die for its mission and its idea. So the question isn't, is Ukraine a real country? The question is, does Russia really exist?
Yeah, brilliant. Peter, you have been just a terrific guest. I can't thank you. And I hope now that you're in Washington for at least a while, I hope some of those American officials, I hope you're already spending time talking to them about how we can engage in a much more robust and effective information campaign than we have in the past. Because, as you say, it's absolutely critical.
Wow. Man, I love the way that you pose a question. It's not the question, is Ukraine a real country? Is Russia a real country? I mean, that's some deaf footwork there, boy. I can tell you right now. That's some real footwork. I really admire it.
Okay, I'm putting that on my wall.
All right, exactly. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I hope to run into you again. Thank you so much.
Pleasure is all mine. Bye-bye.
You know, James, I think it's widely agreed that the global order changed dramatically February 24th when the Russians invaded Ukraine, sovereign country. It's also going to change American politics in significant, if uncertain, ways. For the Democrats, there's going to be a demand for a lot higher defense spending, including more for nuclear, stationing more forces in Europe. That's going to create schisms, and there will be less money for their domestic priorities. For Republicans, the specter of Trump and his warm relationship with Putin isn't going to go away. And there are elements of conservatives that are attracted to authoritarians, especially those who run white, culturally conservative countries. So I'm not sure how it's going to play out. Just a note, an aside, from 1948 to 1988, a central question in every presidential election was national security. From 1992 through 2020, it was really not a primary issue. That may change.
Well, the number of Democrats that, like, want lower defense spending or, you know, want to cut back on overseas deployment is relatively small and not that particularly influential, right? The number of Republicans that admire authoritarianism, that admire ethno-nationalism, is actually a pretty significant part of their party. And also, you know, what's really changed, and remember, according to none other than John Bolton, and you can listen to the tape, NATO is very popular now, and it's going to continue to be popular. There are very few anti-NATO Democrats. There are a huge number of prominent, including Donald J. Trump being the most, that are anti-NATO. Now, again, my whole take on the Squad is they're not evil. They're silly. They're profoundly silly people. The Democratic Socialists of America came out with a no sanctions thing. Now, who the hell knows who the Democratic Socialists of America are? You know, a couple of rich old lady donors, and that's about it. But these people are profoundly naive and profoundly silly. There's a difference between being naive and silly and being evil, nationalistic, authoritarian, all of that stuff. So, you know, yeah, we got to deal with our silly caucus. They got to deal with their evil caucus.
Yeah, I think I surely agree with you on the problems they have. I think Democrat problems will be a little bit bigger than that, because you're right. There's only a small group that wants to cut cut defense funding. We're not going to be talking about cutting defense funding. We're going to be talking about big increases. And those big increases are going to just inevitably take money away from some domestic programs. The Democrats had a basic deal. For every dollar you add to defense, you add a dollar to domestic spending. I don't think that'll fly any longer. And it's not that I don't wish it would, but I think that's what's going to happen. So, we'll see how they navigate it.
It should be a bigger problem, a much bigger problem for them than for Democrats.
Well, you're right. And the specter of Trump is not going to go away. And they don't want to displace
his stupid mouth.
And you mentioned NATO. It was also John Bolton, you know, who said he wanted to get out of NATO in the second term. That's what Putin thought. And Fiona Hill, who we're going to have on this show in a couple weeks, said it was the Trump White House that emboldened Putin. So the notion that some of these right-wingers are trying to spin while still defending Trump wouldn't have happened if Trump was there. Nonsense. It would have been a goddamn disaster if Trump had been there.
All you have to do is listen to what Trump has said about NATO. Yeah. If you don't trust John Bolton, you know, you think Fiona Hill is a part of the deep state, the videos of Trump saying he wanted to get out of NATO, the videos of Trump saying it's obsolete, the videos of Trump not knowing what even the hell NATO was. So it's not just that Bolton says that. There's ample, overwhelming evidence of Trump coming out of his own mouth.
Yeah, and I didn't watch Fox News this week. I paid my penance last week. But last week, it was this remarkable dichotomy where they said, let's get tougher on Putin, and then the next sentence they praised Trump. Those are inherently contradictory, and I also suspect we're going to find out more about what Trump did to embolden Putin and discourage the Ukrainians.
I still think there's a P-tape.
Well,
okay. I'm just telling.
No, I'm not laughing at what you're saying. I'm just laughing at the prospects. If there is, I'm not sure I want to watch it. But
I'm not sure I want to watch it either. But there is clearly any compromise. I think they call it in Russia. There's compromise everywhere. Maybe TP tape. Maybe it's, you know, it's probably 10 different things they have.
You know, I mean, we shouldn't forget that his campaign manager was the chief consultant and paid a whole bunch of money by the pro-Russian Ukrainians to try to defeat, it wasn't Zelensky, but to try to defeat people before like that. And
it was then called the Party of Regions.
Right. So anyway, that's where we are. Okay, we'll be back to this. All right, James, now for those really good questions from our listeners. The first is from Eileen in Wayne, Pennsylvania. Eileen, I used to live there. I want you to go up to Luella Court and wave to my homestead from many years ago. But, James, she has a good question. She says, Donald Trump has a huge war chest. I believe it's over 100 million. I'm not sure that figure's right, but it's close. And it's still coming in. I don't think he's going to share it with fellow Republicans. Donald's not in the sharing. Can he use that to pay his attorneys if he doesn't run for president in 2024? Who gets that money? Or does he use it as his personal piggy bank?
You know, I'm going to refrain because I you know, what I do is I pick up the phone and call an FEC lawyer. But I think he can pay legal fees with it. Mm-hmm. I think you can convert it to cash if you pay taxes on it. I think the law, you know, and I don't know which pool he's raising it in. Some of it can be in a PAC pool, some be in a campaign real leg pool. So your question is a good one. Maybe we have some lawyers out there who can give a better answer than I would. But in this instance, I would just pick up the phone and call a lawyer.
Well, or call our friend Fred Wertheimer, who would know.
Yeah, Fred would know.
Fred Wertheimer, exactly. If you're listening, tell us, and we'll report next week what you said.
And just tell us what the law is and what Trump can or can't do. Yeah, Fred is both a lawyer and a campaign finance expert. So we'll tune in and we'll defer to answer till we get the expert in the booth.
But we'll let you know, I promise, Eileen. I still love Wayne, Pennsylvania. Shane in Minneapolis says, considering the state of American politics today, if you could go back and magically change one thing that would make a difference, what would it be? I'm sorry, Shane, I'm going to do two things. I do two Supreme Court decisions. Two of the worst Supreme Court decisions since Dred Scott, they just were awful. And one was Citizens United, which just opened the special interest money spigots. And the other was Shelby County, which just made voter suppression easier. And it was the beginning of rolling back rights, which our great guest Ron Brownstein talked about last week. So if I could, I would get rid of those two court decisions. There are other things I'd like to do, but those would be big.
You know, You answered it first. I was thinking what I wanted to add to it, and I think your answer is 100% right. I think these two Supreme Court decisions have just staggeringly undermined American democracy, and I none of them were grounded in very much. It's not like these guys like read a law book and look at precedent. They just said, how is it that we can protect and expand corporate power to any extent necessary? And both of those are really about the expansion of corporate power. And that's what's at the bottom of all this. I don't know if they like even inherently racist. I think that they know that the more people vote, particularly the more black people that vote, the worse it is for corporate power. I think that is, for most of them, the altar they worship on, and we're paying the price for it.
Yeah, no, I agree. One more. Jeff in Marin County, California. We both love Marin County, California. He's a good question for you, James. He's wondering how Governor Youngkin is doing in the state of my childhood, Virginia. It was my childhood, too, before I went to Pennsylvania. He said, Jeff was a little surprised to see his approval rating is not so good. Every policy proposal he ran on, Jeff says, is being rejected. Can you tell us about that and reflect for a moment, how do people get elected when a clear majority of voters reject what they're selling? And as a P.S., Jeff says, thanks for the Blinkist discount. All the books I'm reading are done in minutes now. Good for you, Jeff. Anyway, James on Youngkin.
Well, first of all, you can tell that he's a smart guy because his Blinkist habits and his question. And it's a good question because, you know, he was the guy in the vest and was the kind of good Republican. Unlike Trump, he was couth, and people are starting to see this for what he was. He ran on unpopular proposals. Terry just got caught up with a lot of left-wing craziness that he had nothing to do with, and just a kind of bad cycle and, you know, bad presidential approval numbers. I think that the Republicans are vesting a lot of hope of McCormick in Pennsylvania. You know, different people you can see, the guy running in Ohio, this kind of hedge fund, private equity. Yeah, I like Trump, but I dress better than he does, and I'm not as uncouth as he is. I don't think that's going to be a sustainable model over a period of time, but it certainly is a sustainable model right now.
Yeah, it is. You know, there was a survey out this week. I find the numbers hard to believe, that it wasn't the parents, the teachers' issues that hurt Terry McAuliffe as much as a huge turnout among people, older voters. And that went against him. And I
Rockingham County, which, as you know, because you went to my daughter's wedding, Shenandoah County.
Yeah.
The county right south of Shenandoah is Rockingham. Right? You got to take out the city of Harrisburg, because it's Harrisonburg, because it's an independent city. They had a higher turnout in 2021 than they had in 2020 without Trump on the ballot.
What was it, you think?
I think it, I'll be honest with you, I said it on your wife's show the day after the election. I think it was all this woke crap that just people were just, it stimulated.
Yeah.
But we could go on now.
Okay, here's a question, James, from Paul in San Antonio, Texas, who says that he's a very big fan and never misses an episode. That's great, Paul. You're in our A-list now. But he also loves Magic Spoon, so that's two for two.
Wow.
He asked, what do you think of Rui Scheera, who was a guest about a year or so ago on this show, one of the authors of the emerging Democratic majority, who thinks the cultural left puts a ceiling on Democratic support?
You know, first of all, it's Bexar County, Texas, and it's spelled Bexar, but as I recall from my time in Texas, it's pronounced like the Bale of Bears. I think Rui Teixeira is, if I had to pick, I don't know, five smartest observers of American politics of my time, there's no doubt that Rui would be on. They probably would be higher than number five. And I think the emerging Democratic majority has been somewhat misconstrued. I also like John B. Judas until he became an unwitting stooge of the Russians, but I think he's seen the error of his ways. I think he's a very bright guy. But Rui has been on a show. If I were in a political foxhole, no one I'd rather have on my side than Rui.
Next question, James, from Mary in Illinois. Yep. Mary, I wish you would have told
Mary
us.
Oh, Mary in Illinois. That's Mary Madeline.
Yeah, James married a Mary from Illinois. Right. We could compare notes. She asked, do you think Russia's ongoing war against Ukraine will have any effects on the way we plan, they plan to interfere in our 2022 elections? Mary, the one thing I will assure you, they plan to interfere in our 2022 elections because that's what they do. That's what they always do. Weren't very effective in 2020. I think we're a lot more prepared for it. And now that Trump is gone, maybe the Republicans will help Democrats and rise to the occasion to try to prevent them from doing so.
Yeah. I mean, they'll try everything. The truth of the matter is you know, it's relatively early in this. They've been hurt. I mean, we all had, and I talked about this earlier, we had erroneous, and let's face it, we all did. We believed that there was a way that everybody could make money and that they would get a taste of freedom. And that was almost, I know of very few voices that were against this, and I concede that. But they are being exposed as not even, they don't have a second-rate army. They have a third-rate army. I mean, they can't do the basic stuff that armies do. I mean, the Army of the Potomac in the Civil War was better logistically than the modern Russian army. They can't do crap. I mean, it's just amazing when you see how many people they lose, how their supply lines are all jammed, how inept they are, how small their economy is. Hopefully all this exposes something and I hope the Russian people start to see it. They've been massively ill-served by their political leadership. Massively.
Months and months to prepare for this, and their logistics are a total failure. Oh. I mean, that's just incredible. Yeah. Well, I think, as Peter said, the question may be, is Russia a real country?
Right. We start asking ourselves some real questions. I mean, you and I, we grow up obsessed with Russia and, you know, and everything, and it's just exposed itself. To who wears a Russian watch? Who drives a Russian car? Who wears Russian jeans? Russian computer?
I don't even drink vodka, so I don't even drink Russian
and
vodka.
I'm a gin person, so yeah, and that whole thing, I know it's no sacrifice. By the way, Solzhenitsyn is not even made in Russia. Mm-hmm. Like 2% of all of vodka consumed in the United States is Russian made. I mean, they're actually a half-assed, broke-dick country that's getting exposed.
Well, it's not much different than John McCain, who described them as a gas station masquerading as a country.
Well, he knew. Senator McCain
that
credit.
That was dismissed by a lot of people, but it looks more and more the case now. Final question is from Martin in Raleigh, North Carolina. James, you're going to like this one.
All right.
And I love
we
Raleigh.
We love Raleigh.
Is it possible that the anticipated details to be revealed by the January 6th commission will affect the ongoing Justice Department cases of those involved?
Yes. Okay, it just is. They're going to come forward with so much stuff that even us in our, like, creative mind, thinking how crazy they are, they're going to exceed expectations. And, I mean, they've already come up with the Justice Department. I mean, a little bit to their credit. I mean, they've already come up. We found out they had weapons cache and Northern Virginia ready to invade it. Every time you turn a computer, you become a anesthetized because you just keep seeing different things. But when it's put together, and I have some hope that this committee, and propaganda, okay, let's don't use that word. I hope that PR and their ability to roll out a story is consummate to the information that they found, because this is... I don't think it's going to persuade pro-Russian Republicans anything, because if Putin doesn't drive you away, nothing is going to drive you away. And there's more of these people than I'd like to hope, but there's some people out there that are open to information that think that Putin is an evil, bad person.
And they may find out, too, those who don't know already, that Trump is also.
Oh,
all right.
God.
Next week, those questions, keep them coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, let's think of things we can do to internally in Russia to undermine these people. We got to open a multi-front war here.
All right, and now for the outrage of the week. James, we've been semi-defensive about Joe Manchin, who some of our audience really doesn't like. We've noted he represents a very conservative, coal-dependent state. But no longer for me. I'm off any Manchin bandwagon, and not just because he scrolled during President Zelensky's speech to a joint session. That was just distasteful. Far more serious was when he killed the nomination of an eminently qualified Sarah Bloom Raskin for the Federal Reserve Board, charging she would prioritize climate change over fighting inflation. Senator, this was a nomination for the Federal Reserve, not the EPA. Raskin previously served on the Fed board, was Deputy Treasury Secretary, and her nomination was praised by people like Fed Chairman Alan Blinder and Janet Yellen, former Chairman of the Federal Reserve, who know a hell of a lot more about monetary policy and inflation than Joe Manchin. The West Virginia Democrat always looks out for his political and personal interests, which makes me wonder, what was his real motive here? There's a call for some good investigative reporting on this. Joe Manchin, you've lost me.
Well, okay, I admit that I defended Senator Manchin. I'll probably do to some degree. I think some of the things that he's done, I would call him disappointing, but not totally out of character. All right, he is a kind of, plus 70 West Virginia Democrat who's a little bit of a curmudgeon and has a little different worldview.
Yeah, James, I give him that on coal, but not on Sarah Raskin, not in the Fed. I mean, he's just somebody got to him.
Again, they could be other things. It's not sort of totally out of character that he would be against it.
I disagree with it.
From everything I know, this person would have been an excellent thing. But the one that you just can't top his Christian cinema. So she ran as a Democrat in 2018. Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns' new book report that she's going to fund Republican lobbyist fundraisers in making fun of President Biden, in praising Kevin McCarthy and Andy Biggs, in describing herself as an anti-government, anti-tax senator. Well, why didn't you tell us then? All right, I mean, Joe Manchin, say, sort of told you who he was. It could be disappointing. It could be this. It could be that. But it's not totally shocking. I can't wait to raise money for Ruben Gallego in 2024. I just cannot wait. And I can't wait for her to answer is, well, if this is who you are, why didn't you tell us when you ran? It would have been nice to know this. And this is like Andy Biggs is as crazy as any of the crazies they have over there. McCarthy is a pathetic character in modern American politics. I mean, what are you talking about? And if you favor low corporate taxation, why didn't you tell us and run? What's your position on the Rick Scott thing? Maybe you're for it. I have no idea. It would be totally fitting with your current philosophy that you're now telling us about. That's my issue. We always kind of knew who Manchin was. She never told us who she was.
Well, I agree with you on sentiment. Boy, you're letting Manchin off the hook. I'm sorry. He didn't wait a minute. Let me finish. He didn't tell us he was going to vote against Sarah Raskin. He didn't do that for coal. Coal didn't have anything to do that. He did that for financial interest somewhere. And all I'm saying is I'd like some good investigative reporters at the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or so to pursue that. This was an eminently qualified woman who has been endorsed by the people who really know the issue. And suddenly Joe Manchin pipes up and says he's against her for climate change. That does not, that doesn't compute.
I'm not, but he didn't make fun of President Biden and praise Andy Biggs.
No, he didn't do that.
With Kevin McCarthy. Well, I'm just saying, this is like a little bit of kind of what we knew. He this is unbelievable what she did. But at any rate,
they both had bad weeks. Anyway, okay. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carvel, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Chili Sleep, Smith AI, and HelloFresh in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them. When you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.